When it comes to people in life, there are a lot of things that people fear. And one of the things that people sometimes fear is the ability to communicate some information to others. Some of that information might be work-related. It might be a parent-child situation where a parent knows that some information needs to be communicated to one of their young and they're very concerned, they're fearful about how that might be done. It might be in the later years. There's a person who's reached the senior years, and maybe it's a health situation, maybe it's some financial information that they want to communicate, and they're concerned that it's going to be difficult to present, to communicate that information to their kids, even though they're adults. And as we think about the times that God is with us, this is the theme of the lessons that we're looking at. He reminds us that God is with us when we seek to teach His Word. Sometimes people can get kind of skittish about that. They're a little uncertain. Maybe they feel like they don't know enough. Maybe they feel like they're not confident enough. They're not experienced enough. But a lot of reasons for that. And we went through the better part of the material. We got over to page 12. We stopped, I believe, with some information about Apollos, Priscilla, and Aquila. We looked at that Bible study from Acts chapter 18. And then we got down to the point where we're ready for Revelation 2, 20 and 21, and also from the book of Acts, chapter 7, verses 52 and 53. So let's get a couple of helpers lined up. You have a minute or two to get to the passages. Revelation 2, we'll look at that in just a minute. Revelation 2, 20 and 21. Who wants to be a reader there? Josh? And then we'll look at from Acts, chapter 7, verses 52 and 53. Who wants to take responsibility for those two verses? Acts 7. 52 and 53. All right, Lisa, thank you. Okay, looking at the information in Revelation chapter 2, 20 and 21, he says, not everybody loves the truth. Well, would you find that statement to be one that you could agree with? Not everybody loves the truth. Yeah, there's some people that are just not all that enthused about it, and then you have some people that actually hate the truth. They don't want anything to do with it. They have their beliefs, they have their ways, and anything that's contrary to that, it's going to upset their own little world, and they say, you know, you just have your beliefs, I have mine, and we are perfectly satisfied. Well, as we think about people that are in that category, Apollos, Acts chapter 18, was certainly not in that boat. And when we look at Thyatira, we've got a lady there represented by the name Jezebel, and let's see how she styled herself, what she called herself. Revelation 2, 20 and 21. Josh?
Nevertheless, I have a few things against you, because you allow that woman Jezebel, who calls herself a prophetess, to teach and seduce my servants to commit sexual immorality and eat things sacrificed to idols.
Okay, let's fill in the blanks and then we'll think about things. At Thyatira, there was this woman, she called herself a prophetess, claimed that she spoke for God, or at least for a deity. She seduced God's servants to commit what activity?
Fornication.
Fornication, that word means what? We talked about it last Sunday. Fornication is that word which means... All right, any kind of sexual sin. It's that broad word. Adultery is fornication, but fornication is not necessarily adultery. So she was involved with this activity, and she also was encouraging God's people to eat things sacrificed to idols. So you have sexual sin, you have idolatry, both of those things going on with her, and God was not very pleased by it. It's difficult enough when you think about trying to teach someone that's involved with religious error, the truth. But what about trying to actually teach somebody like this? You think some folks might have feared to go up against Jezebel? I mean, after all, how she described, she's a prophetess. You think she had a following? Yeah? I mean, if you're teaching, hey, sex outside of marriage is okay. Here's idolatry, and you know, you can be involved with the things that we're doing over here. Presumably some very fun things, at least in the eyes of many. To stand up and go against her, you're not only going to shake her cage, you're probably going to pick up some heat from where else? Her followers. So when we think about trying to deal with people who are in religious error, depending on how what their involvement with it is, it can become very, very difficult. God certainly wasn't afraid to deal with it. He wanted to make sure his servants were also on the right path. Is there anybody that needs a copy of the material? We want to make sure that everybody's got a copy of the book. Anybody short? Okay. All right, we're ready for our next passage, and this is going to come from Acts 7, verses 52 and 53. Lisa, I think that's yours, isn't it? Acts 7, 52 and 53.
Yeah. Which of the prophets have not your fathers persecuted, and they have slain them with shoot before them, coming to their judgment, of whom you who have received the law by the disposition of angels and not and have not kept it.
Very good, thank you. Let's fill in our blanks. You have here the question, which of the prophets did not your fathers persecute? And not only did they persecute them, what else did they do? They slayed them, they killed them. This is in the middle half of page 12, if you're just joining us. Which showed before of the coming of the just one, that's Christ, of whom you've now been the betrayers and the murderers of. You were involved with the Son of God as far as his death. He mentions the righteous; those Jews killed the righteous Stephen, but God allowed him to see the heavens open and the Son of God standing on the right hand. And that's a good lesson for us. God says, look, when you teach my word, I'm going to be with you. As we'll see a little bit later, that doesn't necessarily mean that from our perspective every single thing is going to go well or it's going to be easy. But God says, regardless of how things go, in the end, what matters? You're on my side. I'm with you. You might be rejected. You might be mocked. You might be beaten. And you might die. But I will see you through it, so you stay the course. And yet for a lot of people, they decide that's too much for me, and we're going to check out. We're not going to stay on board with you, God. And they leave. We saw earlier how, in the first lesson, Elijah had to flee for his life when Jezebel determined to take his life. And he has not been the only fellow that's gone down that road. You've got Jeremiah. He was someone else who experienced some very bad things. When you look at some of the events that occurred to him, one of which being cast into the dungeon. A lot of God's prophets preached to people who did not want to hear what they had to say. But God is with those who teach his word. Anything that you want to add or ask before we move down to the bottom of the page? Right.
I think Simon the Sorcerer was teaching a lot of falls through his magic effects. Yeah. Had a lot of followers, but it was wrong.
Yeah. And there, when you think about those guys, you know, you're kind of involved with the dark side of life, the city side. And even if he didn't have any real power, he probably was associated with some people that were not the best folks. And to stir up those followers, it took some courage. It took some guts for, Philip to go down there and start preaching and say, hey, look, there is truth and life and you're not participating in it. Come out of that way of life.
The other thing you realize is that at that time they didn't have the written word like we do today. And it's a lot easier to know the truth and stand for the truth. Where then, they had different people doing miracles. They see Christ do miracles. They think they're somehow, following him. And
yeah.
So it'd probably been a little harder to figure things out compared to how we are able to figure things out.
I believe that assessment is correct. Sometimes I think we look at the first century and we conclude, well, they had miracles. Well, that may not have been the cakewalk that many think that it was. For example, you see somebody, here's a guy who's crippled, we fixed him up. If you had the power to do that, how do you think a critic might respond? You think they're just going to say, in every case, oh, wow, you've got the power of God. Lo and behold, I'm going to repent and become a Christian. You think that's how it always worked? I don't suspect that was exactly how it always worked. How do you think people sometimes tried to respond to the miracles that were done?
Some of them said they were devils.
We know how they treated Jesus. You're working hand in hand with Satan. So they didn't deny the miracle. They just attributed it to the wrong source. So again, now the Lord's got a new problem to deal with. I showed you power, but now I'm going to have to show that it's not from the devil. So there was that line of attack. What else? All right, and I think that may have been the other big one. He's working with you, this guy, and they could lie. We know that that happened at other times. This guy, he's not a local guy. He just goes with you from town to town. And, when you have a crowd and somebody starts shouting that kind of stuff, you see a similar thing in Acts chapter 2. These guys are drunk. How long does it take when somebody makes that kind of statement before a crowd or in a crowd that some people start to pick it up? Yeah, they're drunk. Yeah, they're intoxicated. And pretty soon what happens to the voice of truth? It's drowned out. It's gone. So, as you say, they did have some things that we don't have. We've got some things they didn't have. But it's no walk in the park, whether you're on our side of the cross or the other side of the cross. But you do have, I think, one thing that's consistent. When you look at the parable of the sower that Jesus gave, Matthew 13, Mark 4, and Luke chapter 8, he talked about the good and honest heart. The good and honest heart would have been convinced by the miracles. The good and honest heart today will be convinced by the Word of God. The hearts that were like bad soil, they weren't convinced by the miracles. the hearts today that are bad soil, they're also not going to be convinced by God's word. So in some respects, things are really the same. It's just that we're dealing with some different tools. Anybody else? It's a good question. I don't know that we can offer a definitive answer, but there are some things that we can know. For example, I'm going to start ahead a little bit and then work back to the book of Exodus. Was Satan able to display some power and do some supernatural things in the first century?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
All right. Why do you think that the devil was allowed to do those things?
Because God was allowed to do what he could do.
All right.
He just proved it.
Remember in Matthew chapter 12, Jesus talks about the strong man. And he says the stronger guy shows up and overcomes him, takes his goods. And the Lord was making the point, who's the strong man, who's the stronger man? Strong man would be a reference to Satan. Stronger man is a reference to Christ, deity, God the Father. All right. And today, you know, you do that same kind of thing. If you're going to have a sports contest, I know that some of the stuff is fake as far as wrestling and boxing, but if you're going to show that this boxer, this wrestler, is really somebody that knows his stuff, that he's really skilled, a world champ, are you going to bring in some weakling, 75 pounds, puny, and, can barely get out of bed? What are you going to do? You're going to bring in a guy that's built. You're going to bring in a guy that's strong. You're going to bring in a guy that is able to put up some fight. Now, he may not be able to beat the champ, but at least he's going to have the ability to fight. And that's what God did. He sort of throws open the door to Satan, allows for the devil to do some things like demon possession, and then comes along through Christ and says, I'm going to stomp you. I'm going to show you. Now, right, and that's what I'm saying. I'm backing up a little bit. Now going back to the book of Exodus, did God use that same principle there? That he allowed Satan to work through Pharaoh's magicians to perform some miracles. Based on what we have in the New Testament, that's entirely possible. I don't know that I can point to anything in the scriptures that says that they were doing those signs, because remember you get to a certain point in the book of Exodus where it says, this is by the power of God.
Yeah.
So they did acknowledge that, hey, whatever we were doing, we've reached a point now as far as the miracles where this is outside. The stronger one is prevailing. I do think with the snakes, they've established there's a particular snake over in that part of the world that you can hold it in a certain area, and that will immobilize a snake. So at least on that one. But when you start looking at some of the other plagues, how you're going to turn blood into water, and you're going to bring frogs, those kinds of things. I mean, in my mind, those are very, very difficult, if not impossible, to replicate with trickery. So I don't know that I would have any objection, based on what we find in the New Testament, to say that God allowed Satan's henchmen, if you will, Pharaoh's magicians, to perform some of the same signs up to a certain degree, and then God said enough. Yes. Yeah. Because remember, this again, the same principle from Mark 16, 15 through 20. These signs are going to accompany you that believe, that is the apostles, are going to accompany you so that people can believe. It's going to confirm the word. And that did confirm the word there as well.
Well, he kind of talks about it where he says that, we've done cast demons out in your name and things like that. So would you think that the miracles, once the miracles were gone, the apostles had passed from this earth, then Satan had he didn't have that same kind of power anymore at that point. God might have allowed it until the miracles no longer exist to be able to show people that, and it was, as we know, the miracles were technically for the Gentiles more than the Jews, because the Jews are supposed to know Scripture.
The Jews should have had sufficient information, but again, the Bible says, John says, I believe it's in John chapter 1, You know, he came into his own, and his own received him not. So, again, even with all the proof that they had in the past and through Christ, I mean, they rejected it. But you are right as far as the correlation there. You have miraculous activity on both sides of the fence. So when one ceased, the other ceased as well. Okay. Was there another hand that flashed? Okay. Let's pick up with the bottom of page 12. He mentions Christians. God's people must remember that the gospel is the hope of man's redemption. Well, if it's our hope, then do we want to hide it or do we want to try to get the word out?
Sure.
It needs to be shared. It needs to be communicated in as many ways as we can possibly do that. And that's just a daily part of our job. Through example, through teaching, through talking to people, sharing information, seeing the one of the study of the scriptures, you know, we are that constant presence to try to communicate God's word. He then says the world has neither the right nor the responsibility to do that. I think that's a great point. And it's not only a great point, it's a point which we can see demonstrated in this area and others. I don't know about you, and I know it's really the wrong kind of year, but anybody have some thoughts when you're driving down one of our main streets and you see a group out there, they're washing cars or selling chicken, or you can just fill in the blank with whatever activity that you want as far as a fundraiser, and they've got a sign out there, fund our mission trip so we can go out and go to, you know, Timbuktu to teach people about God. Anybody see those kinds of things besides me? Okay. Anybody have some thoughts about those things besides me? Wow. We just kind of lit up like the Christmas tree. Bonnie, we'll start with you. I think you had the...
I'm not going to get my car washed to help support that group to go.
Okay.
When I look at that, it kind of goes with this parable when he was talking to the Pharisees, and he goes, who's my neighbor? Deal with the people there right now that you want to convert. They may not have the truth as far as what they're doing and trying to raise money for that, but the fact is, people right next to you don't need to go to another place to fund a, you know, convert those people that are around.
Okay. Ray?
I was going to say basically the same thing Bonnie did. If they're advertising that they're a fundraiser for a particular thing, as far as I'm concerned, unscriptural, I can't support it.
Yeah, but the world, you know, those people are not trying to practice or follow New Testament Christianity. The world, and again, think about the statement, has neither the right nor the responsibility to take the gospel into the world. Well, that's right. Because those two statements are correct, we don't want to fund that. We don't want to participate that. Now, it might be somebody says, well, it's a donation-only car wash. You might have some wise guy that says, I'm going to go through and get my car washed and not pay him anything. Well, I guess that's a different matter. But there are some people who say, well, you know, I'm going to give them just a couple bucks and I figure I came out in the better end of it. Well, again, maybe that's true, maybe not. But still, you know, those folks are not out there trying to take the gospel in its purity to the world. And as he says so well, they don't have the right nor the responsibility to do this, but we do. Additional thoughts before we turn the page. Bonnie?
When I was still working, my boss every year bought all of us in the office a ticket to go down here to the Salvation Army pancake breakfast. And it was very strongly urged that we go. Well, he already bought the ticket. You know, if I didn't go, I was going to be in trouble with my boss if I didn't show up to eat pancakes. But I didn't pay the money to go. I went. Twice I went. When I didn't go, and I was kind of chastised for it. But I figured since I didn't buy it, I figured I was okay. What do you think?
Okay, well, I was going to ask if that was a comment or if that was a question. So I'm glad that you went through that and then clarified for me what we were hoping for. Teresa and I did the same thing. Not that we went out and bought the tickets, but at the time she was working for a place and the fellow that she was employed by, the company there, they were a big supporter of that, and they would go out and get the tickets. Now, not everybody agrees with my philosophy, but here's my thinking. If you've got groups which are not teaching a message that is consistent with the gospel, are they supporting the devil's cause, or are they supporting the Lord's cause? They're supporting the devil's cause, aren't they?
Yes.
I mean, if they're not teaching the truth, then they can't be of God. All right, now, if you look at the group that you referenced, I do not believe that they are setting forth the teachings that we find in the scriptures on some really important items. Now, if you go down there and eat your fill of pancakes, have you taken some money out of the devil's bank account?
That's exactly how
I feel. Oh, I mean, really?
Yeah.
Have you?
Yes.
All right. If you have the ticket purchased, and I'm not saying it's a sin to have the ticket and not go, but if you have someone buy the ticket, no resources tied to that ticket are used, don't you leave some money in the devil's pocketbook that could have otherwise been taken out? Yes, you do. So I don't feel badly about that at all. You know, people will sometimes say, well, you know, let me pass out my Book of Mormon. Or here is the book of, you know, The Key to Science and Knowledge by Mary Baker Eddy. You know, Eddie, send me a case. I'll take all you got. I'll help clean out the devil's pocketbook. I got a dumpster. I don't mind that kind of stuff at all. So people look at that sometimes and they say, that's weird. Well, that might seem a little odd, but my, you know, view is that if we're sucking resources out of those groups that are not doing things consistent with the Bible, then it's not a bad thing. Others may have some additional thoughts or some different ideas. Stan?
Yeah, we could probably talk about this thing all night long. My thought on that would be, what if your neighbor that sees you go to that and thinks, oh, well, that must be a good thing that he's supporting them.
Yeah, and that's possible, but I try to, in those cases, if I see that neighbor, look around and see who might be there. We're here because we were given free tickets. Something we normally wouldn't do. Well, why would you do that? And then maybe open the door to a spiritual conversation. But that is something to be mindful of. You know, there's always, you know, for every positive, there's a negative, and for always, you know, the argument for this, somebody's going to have a counter. But that is something to be sensitive to. Because somebody might say, well, look, I thought you were trying to promote New Testament Christianity, and here's this. So, again, it could complicate things in certain cases.
I think when it comes down to anything we do, better do it in good conscience. If you can't do it, you're constantly fighting your conscience, thinking it's wrong, then you shouldn't do it.
Yeah, and there, again, Bonnie, you could go back to that. Somebody says, I'm bothered by that. Well, okay, if that's where you are in your thought process, that's fine. Maybe that'll be your position throughout your life, and maybe that mindset might change one day. And it's possible for somebody that took the view that we've taken might one day reverse course and say that's something that I don't want to do for the very reason that Stan decided. But I do think that that's a good point, that we'll want to put that in the area of judgment. You know, that's going to be a matter of conscience, and if you want to go or not go for the reasons that we outlined, then you have that right to participate in the way that we described or decline.
It's the same with Christmas.
Sure.
Same thing.
Yeah.
I was raised Catholic, and they'll say, well, why do you celebrate Christmas? I go, I don't celebrate Christmas for Christ's birthday. Uh-huh. But if I did, you can't judge me for that either.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's part of our freedom if we wanted to do it. But I know, as well as you do, we don't know what the day of Christ is, probably in the spring or summer anyway.
Well, it's Romans 14, I think it's verse 5, I'd have to look. But Paul said, one man esteems one day above another.
Right.
Another esteems every day alike. Let each man be fully assured in his own mind. So, again, for those kinds of things...
The new moon at that point, wasn't it?
You've got that over in Colossians chapter 2. But, you've got, like I say, authority there to go ahead and say, this is your position on the day, you've got that right, here's somebody else's view. Don't stomp on their right, but respect it. Stan? I got Stan, and then we'll come back to you, Glenda, I promise. But
well, I was going to say, Paul had the opportunity to say, don't do these kinds of things, and didn't, at the time when he was talking about eating meat offered to idols. He said, we know it's nothing. It's no big thing. It's no big deal. But if it's going to cause my brother to stumble, okay, which means it may not cause his brother to stumble, or there may not be anybody there to know, so it's okay. So, as you said, it's...
There are several things to factor in there and consider. Glenda?
I was thinking about Christmas. It came from the Catholic Church, and it came from the word Christ Mass. They shortened it to Christmas. And they're teaching the doctrine that that's what Jesus is for. And look at, you know, your neighbor has the joy here of smiling and
pointing. Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to take that and add a little bit to it, which is a little bit beyond where you stopped. But when we think about teaching people, we want to make sure that as we consider this information, it's not just about Christians that we teach. Don't you think Christians are also taught and hopefully grow? For many years, I thought, because of what Dad said, he didn't have a lot of religious knowledge throughout his life. But I always thought Christmas, if somebody abbreviates it with an X, Dad's view was they have taken Christ out of Christmas. And I grew up hearing that. I believed that for a number of years until one day I started to study Greek. If you go through Greek, there is a letter chi. And would you like to guess how chi is shaped? It's shaped like an X. So it's an abbreviation. It's not Xing. I mean, Christ was never in Christmas. But that aside, that X is an abbreviation for Christ in the word Christmas. And people, I think, can learn those kinds of things little by little through sermons, through some Bible class discussions. And just like the non-Christian, they can grow and some views can change sometimes. And some of the things that Stan was talking about earlier, they kind of get sorted out. But the problem becomes, and this is also true when you deal with people who are not yet Christians, in trying to sort some things out with people, we'd like to see eye to eye with everybody win. Today or in 10 years?
Today.
Does it always work that way? Okay, yeah. In theory, we would think it would work that way. I mean, we've got the Bible, as you mentioned, you know, we sit down and study the scriptures. But a lot of times, you know, people have some different views. What about parents and kids? You think parents generally want to see or have their kids see things eye to eye like they do? Mm-hmm. How long might that take, though, before things really start to line up? Yeah. 30, 40, 50, 60 years, maybe after mom and dad have died, things finally start, oh yeah, now I understood what they were thinking, and now I agree, but it didn't happen during those earthly years. And we need to be very cognizant of that, I think, when we deal with the Bible and teaching people, whether it's a non-Christian or whether it's someone who's a member of the church. We're going to continue to talk, continue to study, continue to teach, and we're going to exercise patience and love one with another. If you don't do that, which book in the New Testament is going to describe your church? Acts, Romans. Hint, hint. 1 Corinthians. Wasn't that a book that was filled with church strife? You know, there was division over following different people. So, again, some really good lessons here. All right. He mentions this song. We sing it here from time to time. Millions are groping without the gospel. Quickly, they'll reach eternity's night. Shall we sit idly as they rush onward? Haste, let us hold up Christ, the true light. Then he asks this question. In the space below, list some other scriptures which show God blesses those who teach his word. Not always an easy thing as we're dealing with Christians and non-Christians. But were there some passages that you want to share? God blesses those who teach his word. All right. Do you want to read that, or you have that handy, or do you have the basic sentiment in mind? Okay, righteousness, right living. Part of that, of course, is going to be that person who's trying to communicate the good word to others. So that's a good passage. Anybody else? Psalm 5, verse 12. Anybody else? Stan?
1 Timothy 4:16, take heed unto thyself and unto the doctrine. Continue in them, for in doing this thou shalt both save thyself and them that hear thee. So the teaching, I think you were trying to make the point, we're not only trying to save ourselves, but everybody else.
Yeah.
We're working both in within the church and without, but teaching is what brings salvation.
Yeah, and that's a great blessing. The one passage, I had several here, but the one kind of summary passage that stood out to me was in John chapter 15. You know, Jesus said, abide in me, I'm the vine, you're the branches, and so forth, produce fruit, those kinds of things. And, you know, he says, I'm going to love you, you're going to have my peace, we're going to have this great relationship. So God God gave his word, and he's enthused about the times when that word is shared. Okay.
Great commission too.
Yes.
Where he says, I'm with you.
Matthew 28:20. Mm-hmm.
I think of the Sermon on the Mount lesson, continues your network lesson.
Yeah. You know, the pure in heart, how are they going to get that purity? They're going to follow God's word. Blessed are they that hunger and thirst after righteousness. Well, where are they going to get that? It's going to come back to the word. So, yes, some great blessings there. Glenda? Okay. That's not right in my head. So is there a part of that you want to read or highlight?
I just think it's just how God uses those
words to teach
his word
for
me to read it.
Sure. The Psalms are filled with those kinds of sentiments. You have the writer thinking in terms of God's going to protect me, he's going to be my refuge, he's going to be like a mountain, the cleft of the rock, all those kinds of things. If I'll seek him, if I'll follow his word, it will be okay. And that is a really good summary of the lesson. Thank you. Bonnie?
I don't know if he was thinking of 2 Timothy 2:15, but to be approved of God.
Mm-hmm.
That is a big comfort and a reward.
Yeah.
Well,
and that comes through in John chapter 15 as well, 14 and 15. But, you know, you're my friends. You abide in me, abide in my love, you do the things which I've commanded you, you're trying to follow my word, trying to communicate that word. You know, imagine, what is it, James 2, maybe 22 and 23, where Abraham is called the friend of God. You know, you think about that description. God says, you're my friend. Wow! I mean, there might be several people that we'd like to be friends with, but God says, I'm going to be your friend. You're going to be my friend. And I'm going to abide in you. You're going to abide in me. That is, it's a powerful thought. So again, it, you know, ties into this as far as something that is a requirement. I lost track of my hand. Stan, I see you. I thought there was, Ray, did you have a hand or not? You didn't. Okay. Stan, I guess you, and then we'll take a look at lesson four.
I've got two or three here. Mark 10, 28 through 30, where Peter said, we've left everything.
Yeah.
What are we going to get? For that, and he explains that, well, there will be a multitude of blessings if you for doing that. Then 1 Timothy 5:17, 18, in combination with Matthew 10:10, and then 1 Corinthians 9:1 through 18 is a similar thought, and they're all based on Deuteronomy 25:4, where it simply says, you know, muzzle the ox that treadeth out the corn. So you do his will, whether or not you get overflowing blessings, which I believe you do, you at least are sustained.
The first passage was Mark 10, 28 to 30, right, you said? Okay. You know, as I think about that passage, one of the items that pops into my mind is think about the things that people have been promised. Or think about the agreements that people have entered into and they've been disappointed. What comes to mind when you think about agreements that people have been, party two, they've been promised some things and it didn't come true.
Work situation.
All right, you're going to get the promotion, you're going to move into this slot, we're going to open up a new plant, you're going to do this and that over there. So certainly the work that people do has some examples of that. Anything else?
Buying something.
All right. Sometimes, you know, it may be a warranty issue or people say, you know, we're going to do this and that for you. You know, we'll add on this for a little extra money, those kinds of things. But when you think about God, you know, his warranty, if you will, is good. It's not going to be broken. So again, when people go out and share that information and say, this is information you can count on, God is faithful, God is reliable, it ultimately honors God. Lesson 4, page 14, he says, when I suffer for being a Christian. I told this to somebody not too long ago. They were facing surgery, and I said, you know, surgery never seems all that serious until who's on the table? You. I mean, you can go up there and talk to people and encourage them and pray for them, and all that's fine. But you know, when it's you on the table, well, hey, things are a little different. Well, do you think that's also true when it comes to suffering? Oh, I feel bad for you. Well, and, you know, we want to do that, and hopefully we do. But when it's you in the pot, things a little different? Yes. So we all end up there at some point in time. The Bible says we all will suffer for being a Christian if we're truly trying to kind of live that, if we're truly trying to live that kind of life. But the Bible also, bearing in mind the overriding theme of this material, God says, even when you suffer, I will be with you. Doesn't matter if you're like the Old Testament characters that were in the lion's den. Doesn't matter if you're there before Pharaoh. God says, whatever the set of circumstances, you know, you might be before kings and they're not happy with you. You might be before an angry mob. Whatever the circumstances, I'm there, I'm with you. Well, doesn't that make sense from the standpoint of who God is? God says, I'm going to be with you, I'm not going to forsake you. How could we establish that from God's character? Even if we didn't have the passages that we have. God says, I'll be with you, I'm not going to forsake you if you're trying to be my people.
What?
Well, I'm thinking the characteristics of God. What qualities does God have? He says, I'm always going to be with you. All right, that's going to be one. He's omnipresent, so he's always around us. There's no place that he cannot be. And
the providence of God.
All right, I think you can tie in that particular quality, that characteristic. He says, I'm going to be with you. I'm going to help you through it. In addition to being omnipresent, he's also, well, he's omnipotent. So as deity, he's got all power. And when we think about God, how many lies can he tell? None. So if he said, I'm going to be with you always, then that's got to be true. I don't know that I'm going to follow through with this. Today I thought I might take some study nights to look at God's qualities and just kind of do a study on that for a little while. So maybe we'll do some more thinking on that in the weeks that follow. Okay, he mentions many of the passages or scriptures which show that God will never leave his children. Now, there are people who look at this kind of statement in the Bible and what do they conclude with it? Oh! Once saved, always saved. Well, we just made the point that God is all-powerful. He's all-present. He can't deny himself, is what Paul once said. But even though he can't deny himself, he's not going to forsake us. What can we do? We can forsake him. So we have some spiritual responsibilities, and if we fail to fulfill those, then, you know, we can be cut off. He mentions, too, this promise does not mean that he will not allow us to suffer for his cause. He will do that. What may be one of the best illustrations or examples of God allowing his people to suffer, and not just suffer, I mean suffer in the most brutal of ways. Well, okay, I got a couple answers. I'll come back to you in just a second. I heard you a second.
Job.
You said?
Job.
Job, okay. I got the J, I was trying to, okay, very good. Job. When you look at him, all the stuff that he went through, I mean, God was with him. He certainly didn't forsake him. But there was a sense in which God was silent when it came to Job. He's crying out, he's pleading throughout the book. You look at all the speeches, Eliphaz and his other buddies, you know, Bildad, they show up. And, you know, he feels like he's been forsaken, but God says you've not been forsaken. But for the moment, I'm not going to help. We don't know how long he suffered. Some people have, you know, suggested maybe 6 months. But anyway, a week of that would have been more than enough. I'll come back to you in a second, Glenda.
Say the 40 years in the desert.
All right. You think about the wilderness wanderings, God's people. You know, that couldn't have been very pleasant out there. You know, God provided as far as the footwear and some other things. The footwear, the clothing didn't wear out, those items. But still, you've got people dying in the wilderness. The great God has delivered us from Egypt, and now we're not going to head off in the promised land. Now, they should have realized that it was their sin that kept them out, but still.
They still did suffer.
But still, they did suffer. Glenda? They were beaten. You've got in Acts 12, James is beheaded by Herod. And, you know, you might have, I mean, Peter's in prison. Christians are praying for him. So they didn't want, well, you know, where's our all-powerful, where's our omnipotent God? Because he seems to be, you know, just out of commission right now. Yes, Paul does make this, you know, he uses the word naked as he wrote to the Corinthians. Talks about how he was shipwrecked and in peril from brethren and so forth. So, multiple issues in his life.
We mentioned Paul also. Not only the shipwreck, the beating, the stoning, prison.
Okay. What's the greatest example, though? I'm almost shocked that nobody got it yet. All right, Christ. You know, when you think about the statement, again, look at it. The promise does not mean, though, that he will not allow us to suffer for his cause. How did Jesus suffer? Well, he really did. He suffered it all. You got, excuse me, the insults. You've got the scourging. You know, Peter tells us in the Greek text that his back was just like one stripe. You couldn't count the lacerations because of how the text is worded there. You think about the crown of thorns. You think about going to the cross, the nails. Yeah. You know, all the things that that were joined with Jesus, and yet the God of heaven stands by. Stands by and allows that to happen to the point where what does Jesus say? My God, why have you forsaken me? I mean, that sounds like you think Job had it bad, and he did. But Jesus, I think, is the ultimate, the best example. Betty?
I had recently expressed to me that he was beaten from that moment.
What did they mean by unrecognized? Did they explain what they meant by unrecognized? Well, again, I guess I would like a little clarification on that. Were they trying to say that they didn't know it was Jesus? Or were they just saying the beating was so bad that if you came in off the street and looked at him and said, who is this?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's possible. Well, when you think about what happened to the Lord, you've got the beating, but again, you know, you've back and shoulders perhaps. But, you know, you've got blood streaming down the face, the crown of thorns on there, and some other things. You know, we were over at Martin's house yesterday, and I think several here remember Katie. I don't remember exactly how she's... Do you remember?
It's Tina's... Emma, Tina's grandma. Katie is Emma's sister.
Okay.
Carol's aunt.
Okay. She didn't look that different. And she just had on a hat and glasses. And I thought, you know, you kind of look familiar, but... And she said, yeah, Brad, I'm Katie. And I said, oh, how are you? Now, maybe I'm just poor with memory. But we probably... yeah, you are. So, thanks, Ray. But, you know, it's probably been 6 or 7 or 8 years since we've seen her. But again, she still looks basically the same. So if we can not see anybody in 6 or 7 years, they haven't changed that much, and we're thinking, okay, you know, who are you? Not quite sure about your face. Jesus, after he had been beaten up to that point... I think it's at least possible. Maybe it's not probable. Maybe it's unlikely. But at least that, because the gruesome nature of what he experienced.
Well, if you have, you know, the thorn of crown, or the crown of thorns, and the knee's back was basically, like you say, one stripe. But I had never picked up from the scriptures that he had actually been beaten to the point that you wouldn't recognize.
Yeah, I think you have to really make some assumptions there and say it's possible. But biblically, I can't think of anything which would suggest that he was unrecognizable. I mean, even if you go back to Isaiah chapter 53, you know, it talks about him being bruised and, you know, afflicted and so forth. But people there around the cross, I mean, you've got the inscription over the cross, which if they had any questions, I mean, that should have helped identify who the Lord was. But
you would think that he made it so Christ wasn't recognizable when he was walking.
Yeah.
To say it was unrecognizable.
Yeah, I can say that.
It was pretty beat up, I'm sure, but you still knew who it was.
Yeah. Well, and even, you know, sometimes you just really don't even need to see the face. Just right. The way that people act. They are able to conclude, this is what's going on, this is who the person is, those kinds of things. So, I think I might have asked another question there, or if you get another chance to ask a question, maybe follow up and say, where'd you draw that from? Anybody else? Bonnie?
Do you think that Mary and Joseph suffered?
Yes. You have, I think, multiple things there. They're so young. You know, some have suggested that Mary may have been a teenager, you know, maybe as early as 13, 14 years of age. You've got them fleeing into another country in those early years. You've got her having a baby. You know, and people start asking you questions, you know, how do you say, well, this angel showed up? You know, she goes to see Elizabeth and apparently gets some consolation there. But, and Joseph, you know, hey, you got her pregnant. Well, you know what the Jewish law says about that, those kinds of things. You know, they could do math back then. So they had to have it tough.
Well, when Jesus went back to Nazareth,